Toledo Astros fans, welcome to the first TCB podcast, and hopefully my last really bad Milo Hamilton impersonation. I'm David Coleman. You may know me from the site. And what we've got for you today is a lot of prospect talk. We're going to talk about a prospect list that we put together. We all rated the prospects. We numbered them. We'll get into the scale in a minute, but basically the numbers correspond to letter grades that you're more familiar with. And we averaged all the grades out, and we got a list of prospects to talk about. So look forward to that. First off, why don't we get to introductions?
All right, I'm Christian Seehausen, and you know me as 4MLK.
I'm Brooks Barker. Y'all know me as Subber 10, and y'all know me from all the minor league recaps.
And I'm Timothy D. Block. You know me as Timmy.
Okay, and of course, Tim is our non-minor league guy. He's had some opinions about it, but isn't quite as into it as the rest of us are. So it's really interesting to see all our grades put together. Overall, what did you think of how the list came out?
A lot of new guys that are high on the list. I wasn't expecting quite as many as high, but I mean, that's the way it came out. Even when I did my own grades, I realized I had to put a lot of the newer guys higher than I expected.
Right, I noticed the same thing. I felt like a lot of the guys were probably kind of borderline, like just outside the top 100, maybe in the top 150, top 200, if you're a little more pessimistic. The only one is obviously Jordan Lyles is a surefire top 100 prospect, but I didn't think any of the other ones were like definitively in that range nationally.
Yeah, and I think I would agree with that. I think the biggest change this year is we have a lot of that in that top 20 group of some really high-ceilinged players. You know, guys you can really see turning into something special down the road if everything hits right.
And that's, right, and if you're going to have depth like that, that's really good to have.
Mm-hmm.
You know, you obviously want to have a lot of top 100 prospects, but if you're going to have depth instead, it's really good to have guys who can become that. And we have a lot of high-ceiling guys like that.
When I think Heck has taken the approach that to kind of get more prospects in that, you know, if one prospect fails and has a really high ceiling, your minor league system isn't going to get as hurt as bad with more of a solid foundation in it, which I think a lot of the guys are.
Well, and you can definitely see that from the 2008 draft, because Jordan Lyles has obviously flown through the system, but Ross Seton and Brad Dadalowitz have really tanked this year. And, you know, one out of three is pretty good, but if you were counting on those other two guys being rotation mainstays, you know, as you're the rest of your depth in your organization, you'd be in trouble.
It's kind of what you do. I mean, if you're going the raw, high upside route, getting a lot of high school guys and just a lot of guys who you think have potential, that they're probably not going to be high floor guys as well, or otherwise they'd be like top 10 picks in the entire draft. So, you know, you're going to have some failures anytime you go that route.
But I think Heck and Wade have done a real good job of, you know, finding a pretty good balance where we do have a lot of high upside guys that we take later in the rounds, but we still have enough college guys to with the high floors and not necessarily high ceiling, but, you know, they're able to maintain just a, you know, a level playing field, so that when Ross Seton and Brad Dadalowitz, you know, they do fail, if they do, it's not that big of a hit. I think, you know, next year will probably be a really big turning point in that draft where we do see a lot of the real, real high ceiling guys get taken by us and get signed and put into the system.
Right. I think it's been gradual. Because it started out and we took Jason Castro first, obviously, a really, really just high floor, low ceiling type guy. And it's been gradually more and more high ceiling type guys. And especially in this year's draft, I felt like there was a lot of that.
Well, and all the rankings, that we have, just looking at them, you can see just about every single one of them has been drafted since 2008. You don't see any 2007, 2006. Brian Bogusevic is you know, I think it was 2005 draft, and he had to go through a transition to a hitter from a pitcher. So it's kind of nice to see that in the last few drafts there are so many guys coming in and doing a good job. Mm-hmm.
Yeah, we're finally erasing the legacy of Tim Perpura. Yeah, you know, Kobe Clemens is about the only guy that's an actual prospect that we drafted from 2004 to through 2007.
Right. I was going to say Colin Delome is the only one who's still like prospect age and is at the upper levels of the system. I think he was from 2007, wasn't he?
Yeah, he was the top pick that year in the fifth round.
And he's barely even a prospect by a lot of people's standards.
Yeah, I mean, I think he's got the power that he can stick in the majors at some point as a fourth or fifth outfielder. And he's fairly athletic, so he could probably play each of the corners, but I don't see him being a regular contributor to a major league team at this point.
Yeah, I was looking at his stats earlier today, and his power is just ridiculous.
Mm-hmm.
But other than that, he just strikes out way too much, and he doesn't get on base nearly enough. Like, his on-base percentage is .270. But yet, because of his power, he still is able to have an over 7-0.
Yeah, yeah. He's definitely got enough power to be a force on a lineup. But, you know, one of those one-dimensional guys only gets you so far.
Yeah.
Well, he's a pretty good athlete. You know, he's got a little bit of speed. He's got the tools. The problem is just that his plate approach, I don't know if it's mm-hmm. pitch recognition or whatever it is, but his plate approach is just terrible. It's absolutely awful. He strikes out too much. He doesn't draw walks. It makes me worry that he's going to really struggle with the translation to the major leagues. But then again, you know, we said the same thing about Chris Johnson last year, and look what he's done. So
yeah, and Delome has definitely showed a lot more power than Johnson ever did in the minors. So
yeah, it's true.
Well, I think the difference, though, is they had a difference in OPS. If you look at mm-hmm. Johnson's OPS numbers coming up through the minors, he actually started low, and he started putting it together. And he actually, from year to year in the minor leagues, he increased his OPS. Looking at the Delome's numbers, his OPS started at .867 in low A ball, and it sits at .721 right now in Triple A. So I think that's the difference between the two right there.
We haven't really seen great signs of improvement from him in terms of his approach and in terms of his production. So, I don't know. I think he could probably be a bench outfielder somewhere, but the kind of guys who strike out a lot, I always tend to worry more that major league pitchers are going to be able to find their holes and exploit them a lot more once they find guys with better control.
That's true. But having a guy like him, who's, you know, a fringe average prospect at best, in AAA means that we don't have to sign the next Jason Michaels in the offseason if we don't want to. You know, we've exactly. got guys like Brian Bogusevich and Colin Delome and even the guy on the current roster that I'm blanking on his name. That
Bourgeois.
Yeah. Yeah. So, you know, and that's been the nicest thing, I think, about the system's improvement to this point, is that we've got some depth in the higher minors so that our bench doesn't have to be free agents.
Right, and it goes on and on, because, you know, there's Shock, and there's John Gaston, and there's, because he's going to be in AAA next year, probably.
Mm-hmm.
You know, there's J.D. Martinez, who may be a regular. There's even Drew Locke is still there, so I just don't see any reason, but this is off the prospect discussion, but I don't see any reason for us to be signing bench guys.
Well, and that's the hope of a minor league system, is that you produce players consistently year to year so that you don't have to go out into the free agent market. That's what, right. you know, that's what Florida did, that's what the Padres have done this year. You pick and choose your spots for guys that'll help you, you know, in the regular rotation or lineup, but not signing guys for multi-million dollar contracts to sit on your bench.
Right. But going back to the overall impressions of the rankings that we've come up with, because I did want to mention that because so many of our best prospects entered the system this year, a lot of them are really in the lower minors and even in short season ball. So maybe, you know, a couple years, even 3 years before we start to see like real fruit out of these prospects. It's important not to assume that all these guys are going to end up being in the majors, you know, next year, and we're going to have this, you know, huge turnaround, even though the farm system is improving.
Yeah, because there is a difference between playing in the South Atlantic League and playing in the Texas League.
Right. Just a little bit.
Yeah.
Well, I think you also have to worry about the Giovanni Mir effect, where he, mm-hmm. he got off to a hot start last year, and he was considered in the top three of our prospects, and right now we have him ranked 10. So.
Right. Well, the hope is, because now that we have, we've added like, well, I don't know how many it is, six or seven or whatever, or, you know, maybe at almost at the level that Meyer was considered to be at last year, that at least some of them will, you know, carry over into full season ball and continue to hit well or perform well.
Well, and I think that's just a product of prospect evaluation in general. Guys you don't have much of a track record with, you can project a lot more easily. And, you know, it's not just us. I think it's Baseball America, all the sites. You focus more on a guy's tools, on his swing, on things like that, and you think he's going to be good. But before you get any results from the little, you know, the short season teams, the rookie ball teams, you don't know. And this year, you know, we saw a lot more out of Meyer, and that's, I think, reflected in our rankings.
And, I mean, like you said, you know, that's reflective in our rankings just because of how he performed. But, I mean, I think, yeah, since even though Meyer is down there at number 10 or whatever, I think he's a little bit, he should be a little bit higher than that, because in all actuality, his actual talent level is higher than what we've seen this year. We see that from his improvement over, like, since the All-Star break. But at the same time, he's not as good as what he showed last year.
Yeah. Well, let's tackle the grading system just so people have an idea of how we did that. And then let's talk about some specific players. So basically what we did was grade every prospect on a scale from 1 to 10. And then assigned a letter grade to those that correspond somewhat with John Sickles' grading system. So a 10 is obviously an A+, and that's, you know, better than Steven Strasburg, basically. An 8 is an A-, which is a top 25 player. A B is a top 100 player, and that's a 6. And then a C+ is a 4, and anything below a 2 is not really a prospect. So that kind of gives you an idea when we're talking about, like, how our individual grades rate out. In case we slip and we talk about a grade or a number instead of a letter, you can get an idea of that. But one of the things, I wanted to start off with Meyer because we were just discussing him. I had a significantly lower grade on him than I think the rest of you did. And one of the reasons was from the scouting reports from Scouting the Sally, which is an excellent website if you haven't gone there. I know we linked to it quite a bit. I just really worry about his lack of explosiveness with his bat. You know, that's not something that gets better over time. Maybe he gains muscle, maybe he just needs to develop, but not having bat speed at this level, it worries me quite a bit.
Well, actually, the Baseball America article that came out, I guess it was yesterday, the day before, that actually talked about, you know, it actually said that he has obvious bat speed. And so, I mean, you kind of get conflicting reports, yeah. You know, when scouts watch them at different times of the year. Like, I know I was actually talking to Mike Newman about it after his scouting report on Meyer came out about, you know, getting a frame of reference, you know, of when the scouting report was actually taken and his statistics at that point. And then, because, like, I know there's tons of, you know, articles that came out about how much Gio was struggling and he was constantly adjusting his approach and working with the hitting coach. And I mean, you could just see sometimes in some of the videos of him, he was hesitant. He wasn't, You could just tell that he wasn't sure about every single swing. And so, you know, if he's struggling at that point in time, you know, if he's hesitant in that swing, he's not going to have the pop.
Mm-hmm.
You know, it's going to be a thud instead of a pop when that bat hits the ball.
Right.
And so you just got to – you have to get a real frame of reference when articles are actually, you know, released and what's going on at that point in time.
And I think a lot of that is why they like to look at batting practice, because a lot of it is it's a confidence thing. And I think that's what you're talking about. And I noticed that too. It looks like his bat is slowing down on the Scouting the Sally video. It does look like it's slowing down in the game action that he took. But then it cuts over to the batting practice. And it looked to me, and maybe I'm wrong about this because I'm not an expert, it looked to me like it was popping off the bat. The ball was popping off the bat. And he did have good bat speed in batting practice. So I think, you know, there may be something to that.
I think they need to just get rid of weights altogether. I think I saw a TV show once that showed that they did the thing where you had weights on a bat and then one without a, you know, player swinging without a out weight before he swings. And they say that the weight actually makes your muscle memory. When you swing with a weight, it's going to slow your bat speed. It's down because that weight's on there. So your muscles remember that. So when you go up to hit, you're going to slow it down. But if you swing without weights, you're obviously going, your muscles going to remember that as well. And it actually helps your bat speed. So and that's just something I think even at the major league levels they need to get rid of is.
You see Hunter Pence doing that all the time.
Yeah, he swings like three bats or something.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
So I don't know if that is the effect, but that's something I've always kind of worries me a little bit. That especially these guys know way more about hitting than any of us can comprehend, and it just seems like something like that they'd kind of figure out, especially with, you know, the TV shows that show it. Maybe someone's done an article on it.
Yeah, and I've heard that too, and it makes sense. I mean, you know, it feels like you're swinging faster because you don't have the weight on it, but that's probably not the case because you're used to the timing from the bat with the weight on it. So yeah, I mean, that's something that makes sense when you think about it, but you can also see why players would think that it helps them in the first place. But I think with Meyer, you know, we're talking about the difference between my grade and the rest of your grades, and I had him as a C-plus guy. And I kind of think that from his season, I know he's been making adjustments and has apparently really improved in the field from the beginning of the season till now. I think he was dealing with an injury earlier. I see him as a C-plus guy that could definitely get better and jump into that top 100 next year, depending on how he does. You know, he develops some consistency, he grows a little bit. You know, I think he's still a teenager. I think he's 19. So, you know, having him as a C-plus guy, definitely with that upside caveat on there. And really, I mean, it's not so different than most of you had him as a B-minus guy, so.
Right. Well, for me, the reason I went with the B-minus is because when you look at his peripheral numbers and whatever goes into his performance this season, what stands out to me is that he really knows what he's doing at the plate. He's got, you know, a good walk rate, or at least, you know, a little bit above average, which is good for a shortstop. You know, his strikeout rate isn't bad at all. I think the main thing you see is that he's not making the kind of solid contact and hitting for power the way he did before. But just having good plate discipline, having a good plate approach as a plus defensive shortstop is something that I think will help him as he moves up the levels. And if he does put on the muscle mass and he gains more confidence in his swing and whatever else, he begins to make that solid contact again, then I think there could be something special there, even if he just hits 10 home runs.
Yeah, and I mean, that's why I gave him also the B minus, is that, you know, there's projection still left in that. You just look at him and you can see how lanky he is, but at the same time, you can see that he definitely has room to fill out and add some muscle mass. And because he already does, you know, he knows what he's doing at the plate, like Christian said, that's something that he can still improve on and make even better. But the power doesn't really show up until, you know, he's 22, 23, maybe even 24, is when it, you know, really, really starts to develop. So the fact that he's already hitting tons of doubles anyway, just it makes me see that he really does have the potential to, you know, have a lot more power to him and be able to put on a much better OPS than what he's doing right now.
And you got to remember that even if he's just a 750 OPS guy at the major league level, if he's a plus five run shortstop, then that's actually a really valuable player. So,
exactly.
And yeah, I think the age of power hitting shortstops is dying out now. You don't see that nearly as much, and you see a lot more guys that are defensive first. Get on base a little bit here or there, and you know, as we were discussed, can hit that double.
Well, and right. It's funny that the age of power hitting shortstops died with steroids. So
what a coincidence.
Yeah. So okay, and you know, that's something we're quibbling over Myers' grades. He's a top 10 guy. We've got him at number 10. The rest of the list, last year he was a number 3 guy, so he's fallen a little bit, but he's still one of our most highly ranked prospects. Obviously, the top ranked guy right now is Jordan Lyles. Somebody want to talk about why they graded him? Tim, I see you and I both gave him an A-.
Yeah, I mean. Just from what I've seen, every level he's been able to get the job done. He's struggling right now in AAA, but I think that might be due to the fact that he has moved up so quickly and he's probably tiring out a little bit. And I don't put a whole lot of weight on his AAA numbers. I'd kind of like to see what he can do in a full year next year, although I'm afraid that he won't get that full year and the team will call him up at some point next year. A September call-up wouldn't be so bad, but I certainly would like to see him have a full year at AAA, but I still have him pretty high just because he's moved through the system so quickly. I think he still is 19, mm-hmm. So if the Astros had called him up, he would be, you know, one of the few 19-year-olds to make it
right.
To the major leagues.
He does turn 20 in October, I think. So, yeah, still a teenager.
Yeah, so him making it that far and on the brink of the major leagues, which is actually what his goal was. I remember reading that his goal mm-hmm. was to make it to the major leagues at the age of 20, which is very, very likely next year. I think just is why I rated him so high.
Right, and I'd said before that Doc Gooden was the last teenage pitcher to debut in the National League. And it's true, but with a caveat that Madison Bumgarner debuted last year in his age 19 season, though he had already turned 20 by the point that he debuted. So,
while Doc Gooden was great, Lyles is definitely not at that level. But no. Because Doc Gooden fell out so early, he may have had other problems off the field, but that kind of worries me that him making his debut in September could mean that he could be having issues with injuries in the future. So I don't mind him taking off this offseason and just kind of resting a little bit.
Well, and here's the thing that I wanted to talk about a little bit too, is that I've watched him pitch on video. I haven't seen him in person, but I've watched him pitch on video a bunch of times this year. And when you look at him right now, he's a great prospect, but his current stuff is not like he's in top of the rotation. He's not going to come out and be an ace. Like, if you brought him up to the majors this year, he would be a back of the rotation starter. You know, he could probably pitch in the majors in terms of his ability, but he doesn't have elite velocity. He sits around 91 miles an hour on his fastball. His breaking ball is inconsistent. You know, sometimes it's above average, sometimes it's flat. His changeup is typically pretty good. But what evaluators are looking at with Jordan Lyles, they're looking at this guy's 19 years old. He's incredibly advanced for his age to have like a plus pitch, a pitch that looks like it's going to be above average, to have such an incredible command, which is his best asset for his age. And then they say, you know, this guy's projectable, he's tall, he's going to add some strength. You know, in 3 years, maybe he's sitting 93, 94 miles an hour on his fastball. His command's going to be even better. His breaking ball is going to be consistent. You know, where's his changeup going to be? That's why he's such a good prospect. So there's not really much point in rushing into the major leagues right now because he's just a number 4 starter at this point in his career. And you're just wasting his major league service time and you're slowing down his development and you're risking injury by bringing him up like this September or even early in next year. It would be kind of pointless. So you let him set his own pace, and whenever he does look like he's ready to step in and be at least like a middle rotation guy in terms of his stuff, and that's when I think he should be called up personally.
Well, let's be honest. They're not going to – there's a very low chance that the Astros will be competing next year. So, and even if they are competing next year, you don't really want to throw a rookie into that kind of scenario and have him, you know, pitching stressful innings. You know, I think in a couple of years after he's kind of established himself is when he'll really be valuable.
Well, right. You know, having him as the fourth starter, if he does have great control, like I think is his – biggest strength right now. Anybody that's seen Bud Norris in that fourth spot this year would probably prefer to have somebody that could have a few less walks. Though Bud has done better lately. I don't want to rag on him too much, but it is frustrating when a guy walks the bases loaded like Bud did earlier tonight. And like I say, I mean that's the thing about Lyles that I think makes him so special is he doesn't have overwhelming stuff. But his control is so good that he's, you know, been able to strike out a lot more people than he should have. Even at AA, where the players are usually more advanced, you find some of the best prospects. He dominated them as a teenager. And you know, without elite fastball velocity, like you were saying, Christian, because that changeup is so good that he can get guys fooled on, and he can hit his spots really well.
And that's the thing that you saw. If you were watching his starts, you would notice that so many of his strikeouts were looking. Mm-hmm. And the thing is, though, that doesn't play as well. You know, nothing does. But, I mean, it even gets reduced more maybe than swinging strikeouts mm-hmm. in the majors because guys are a lot better at fouling off those pitches and waiting until they get something that they can hit than minor league hitters are. They're not going to get frozen as easily.
And, I mean, that's one of the things that I think I attribute his lesser success at AAA is that the strike zone is so much more tighter at AAA. And so a lot of his strikeouts in AA and low and everything else, have a lot of them have been nearly as many as those strikeouts in AAA. But that's the thing with Lyles is he is so projectable. He is, you know, he does have that possibility of having that fastball probably sitting around, you know, all the way up at the highest, probably 94. Doubt he'll get that high, but because he's able, he can have that better fastball and that so much more power to every single pitch, which will allow him to be a whole lot more better than what.
Well, and I think you know we're all worried about the Astros bringing him up this year or early next year, and I think rightfully so because I just don't think he's developed enough to play in the major leagues at this point. But I think there's some hope in their organizational philosophy from how they handled Jason Castro this year. You know, they certainly could have started Jason Castro out as the starter in breaking training camp, bringing him up at the beginning of May, and they waited, even getting Kevin Cash on the roster ahead of him, because he wasn't ready yet. And he was an older guy, and they expected him to be ready sooner, but they still played him at AAA, got him that experience, and then brought him up. So I think if Lyles does really need the development at AAA, that I think there's a good chance the Astros keep him there for a good while next season.
Well, I think Castro kind of, he got beat out by Tolles in spring training.
Mm-hmm.
And then the reason Cash was obviously brought into the roster, so that was a good move by them to keep Castro in the minor leagues, which may have been more of a financial move to keep him out of the Super 2 status, but once Manziela went down in June, they traded Cash for Sanchez, and you know that created a spot for Castro. So you know the only thing I'm worried about is I mean if all the pitchers come to camp that are currently on the roster healthy, I think there is a good chance that they'll stay in the minor leagues. However, if one or two of them get injured or struggle, we could see Lyles possibly, especially if he does very well in spring training, up in the major leagues. Which I don't know if you know how well that would go over, because of the lack of depth we have in the minor leagues.
That's a really big risk. Being you know Bud Norris had his injury this year, and then Paulino's still in the DL. If Paulino, he might come back this season, but if he doesn't heal, and he ends up having another injury in spring training, similar to what he has right now, we very well could be looking at a Lyles debuting at the beginning of next year, which, I mean, I really don't want to see, just like the rest of you.
Yeah, that's probably the worst case scenario. But in the ideal scenario where nobody gets hurt and everybody is producing well enough at least to play, I think they will let Lyles set his own pace. And, you know, if he's dominating, then they'll call him up after June. And if he's struggling, then, you know, they'll just leave him down there even the whole year or however long it takes.
Well, but I think that says something about the organization right there, is that they can't just leave him in the AAA for an entire year, even if he is tearing up AAA. You know, if, like you said, if he's struggling, then, yeah, they're going to keep him in there. But if he's tearing it up, we could see him in June, which, I'd like I said, I'd like to get a full season there and tear it up. But if he's tearing it up and there's an injury to a pitcher, we could very well see him mid-year next year.
It depends for me, because the reason he's tearing it up is, you know, he's added a mile or two an hour on his fastball. He's improved the consistency of his secondary stuff. His command is better, and he's just generally a major league ready pitcher. Then, you know, okay, as long as you're not wasting service time and you wait until that Super 2 eligibility is gone, you know, that's all right. But there's not really any reason to leave him there to not be talented. But for me, I definitely want to see him.
Yeah, if he is throwing 92 and, you know, that curveball is more consistent, then if we're competing and he's hot, go ahead and call him up as long as he's out of Super 2. But, I mean, that's best case scenario.
Right.
Well, okay, here's a thought, too. Dallas Keuchel is our ninth best prospect, and he made it up to Corpus Christi this year. Now, he didn't exactly light up Corpus Christi, but because he's an older guy, he is a candidate to go to AAA. If both he and Lyles are in the rotation there and there's an injury, do the Astros call up Dallas over Lyles because he's an older guy and probably would stand up to it better? Or do they still call up the young guy and put the pressure on his arm?
That's an interesting question. I mean, like you said, you know, Keuchel very well could be starting off in AAA next year. While he hasn't dominated, he's still having a very, very solid ground ball rate, which is what you really expect out of a guy like Keuchel, because he doesn't have the dominating stuff. He's a soft-tossing lefty, but he has so much movement on his fastball and everything else that he induces a lot of ground balls. But in that scenario, it plays into more than just, you know, are they both doing well? Because everyone is aware of Lyles, you're going to have a lot of pressure from the media and the fans bring up Lyles.
I was thinking the same thing, and I would love to see them, if Keuchel is doing well, I'd love to see them call him up instead, obviously, but, you know, like Brooke said, I don't know if they'll do that.
Yeah, I think that'd be the same for me. As Dallas would be the person I call up, but I think Lyles is going to bring out some more fans to the games and create some excitement as well, so I think that's what the organization will have to weigh on, whether they want to do what's good for the players or what they want to do for, you know, financial reasons. And I'm not so sure that the financial reasons would take precedent over what's good for the players.
Well, I think you guys are underestimating TCB's power. We could certainly throw people behind Dallas and get them excited about him over Lyles. Come on. I mean, we're like one of the third sites, you know, talk about Astros media bringing pressure. We're one of the big three, so our pressure counts just as much as everybody else.
That is true. J.D. Martinez and Dallas Keuchel were brought up the day of or the day after I wrote something on a recap, so who knows?
Exactly. But more on Keuchel, what do you guys see his ceiling as being? Is he this soft-tossing lefty that's, you know, a back-of-the-rotation guy? Do you see this year changing your opinion of him?
I like him a lot. I love the way he goes about his business in terms of pitching. He's got great poise, and he throws strikes, and he gets ground balls, and, you know, he keeps pitchers honest by throwing the ball out of the zone enough to get strikeouts. But at the same time, you're talking about a guy who throws 86, 87 miles an hour, and he's going to battle that at every level. In terms of people doubting that he can get hitters out, even at AAA. So, you know, realistically, most prospect evaluators would probably say, okay, this guy's, you know, maybe a swing man in the rotation. He's maybe a lefty-only guy. For me, I think he could be at least a number four starter because I don't place as much importance on velocity as other people. But, you know, we'll have to just wait and see how he does at the upper levels of the farm system to be sure.
I was actually under the impression that he threw a little bit harder than that. I was thinking that he threw, like, he sat at 88 and touched 90 on an occasion. But that was also, I think, an article right after he was drafted from a news station from around the Fayetteville area, so they're a little bit biased. But he has a lot of movement on his fastball, and he's got a good curve, and he loves his slider, and he's got a decent changeup. So I mean, I can see him being a number three. That would probably be what I would call a ceiling. And you know, maybe if he does something, I don't know what he could possibly do, but maybe he could turn into somebody like Wandy and actually be a number two. But I see him more as a number three, number four pitcher.
I actually see him as more of a Brett Myers, but that's just solely based on his Twitter picture, which shows him having a wicked goatee.
Well, I mean, I'm a little bit of that same attitude as Brett Myers, too, doesn't he? Some of those Twitter posts.
Well, yeah.
He really does. He definitely has a very, very strong attitude that he really, really competes. I don't know if any of y'all watched him in the College World Series mm-hmm. when he was at Arkansas hit that last year. But, I mean, he really, really knows how to compete. He has a lot of intensity to him. So, I mean, he definitely, just because of how he competes, probably plays over his stuff because of that. But, I mean, I don't see him as the number one by any means, or probably not even a number two, to be honest.
Well, that's the interesting thing.
I can see a scenario where he develops into a number three, a middle rotation guy. I think, you know, that could be a best case for him. But I don't think most prospect evaluators would even go that far from what I've heard. But
I agree, but I'm also a little bit higher on him because I do have that connection where I watched him in the College World Series. And I just loved him. Like, right. But, I mean, that's because I'm biased and I really like him. But, you know, I can definitely understand
guys.
That.
We see examples of guys like with this kind of velocity, like Andy Pettit and mm-hmm. Ted Lilly and other soft tossing lefties who do end up being number two, number three guys throughout their careers, or at least for, you know, stretches after they really get settled in, long stretch of like three or four seasons. So it's not out of the question, but a lot of them did start out with higher velocity and really learned how to pitch to major league hitters, which is the argument you're going to hear. So. You know, it's going to be a knock against him that he doesn't throw 90-plus miles an hour.
That's typical. And I definitely understand where prospectors are coming from with, you know, thinking more of a number five, number four at best. And I can definitely see that is definitely a much more likely scenario.
All right. So let's move on to the number two guy on our list. It's a guy that I don't think any of us have seen more than about 30 seconds of video on. Ariel Obando. We've talked about him in the past on TCB. He got the fourth biggest signing bonus internationally ever.
Largest in club history, I think, for an amateur.
Definitely in club history. And I think, you know, the non-Japanese players, professional players, I think he was like fourth or fifth overall in the biggest signing bonus ever given out. If you're not going on much video, you can certainly see that the bidding for him was probably pretty steep, and the Astros had to pay a pretty good price to get him. So I was probably the highest on him. I had him as an A-minus guy because I love his ceiling. I think he could be a great hitter, but we also don't know anything about him. So you guys shoot down my ridiculously high grade.
I gave him a 6, but I also like doing these lists, I put a lot more weight on what they've actually done up to this point and what they've shown statistically, just because we aren't able to get a watch on him. We can't really see a whole lot of video. He definitely does have a ridiculous ceiling, but because he's so young and he's so far from the majors because he hasn't played a single game, then, you know, his floor is a whole lot lower.
I read an article the other day where they talked about these Dominican prospects, and they have these guys who basically take them and train them up to do batting practices and to do like 60-yard dashes and all these showcase things, but they don't play very much. They don't play very many actual baseball games. There's always the question with these guys, like pitch recognition is the biggest thing. It's so important, being able to recognize a breaking ball, being able to recognize where something is pitch is going to wind up in the strike zone. How do they do in game situations? You don't know until you see them perform, and we don't know anything like that about Rondo. And his tools are incredible. He's got, like, superstar tools. But I can't put a guy in the top 100 until we know a little more about how he does in game situations. And you would even know that with, like, a college hitter in the U.S., for example. But we don't know that with Rondo. So even if he has the best tools in the world, we don't know what his skill level is at this point. And I do love his tools, by the way.
Well, and I agree with that. I know that I'm probably too high on him because he's a 16-year-old kid. I mean, honestly, there's no way you can project somebody who's 16 years old to how he's going to do in 6 or 7 years down the road when he's got a chance to make the majors. There's just so many different things that can change because no 16-year-old kid has enough experience playing baseball at any level, no matter what they've done, to recognize a good breaking ball, to hit a 90-mile-an-hour fastball with the movement on it. There's just so many factors in there. And so I think with a guy like that, you have to rate him on his tools. And that's why I had him so highly. Like I say, my thinking was I can rate him this highly because we've got, you know, four other guys that are also going to be rating him. And while it's going to skew at some, we're going to get a consensus that's probably a little more down to earth. And I think we do. I mean, we've got him at a 6.6 average, which is a top 100 guy. And that's probably a little high. But I think with his tools, he's definitely right around that B-minus range, that B, with the possibility to go higher once he gets some experience.
Hold on, I just rated mine as a 2. He's down to a B-minus guy now.
See, you got to spoil my point.
And now he's actually, let's see here, he's not even...
That drops him to...
That's like a number 4, right?
Yeah.
4 is still pretty good.
4 is...
You know, and that kind of speaks to the state of the Astros system. Even though it's improving, it's still, you know, kind of down there a little bit.
Well, and I'm really going
to
be...
They're also interchangeable at that level. Mm-hmm. The whole top 10, to me, is very close.
Mm-hmm.
You know, they're all within, you know, a very close range. And you can see that in my grades, right? I have them all like 5 to 5.5, which is a B-minus.
Mm-hmm.
to just getting closer to a B.
Yeah, and the last thing I wanted to talk about on Obando real quick is where do you guys see him starting out next year? I assume that they're going to put him in the Dominican Summer League, but I could also see the Astros putting him in the Gulf Coast League. As a 17-year-old, you know, he'd have some time in extended spring training to get used to it, and I'd really be interested to see how he did at that point.
And I think is what the plan was when they first signed him was to actually send him to the academy.
Mm-hmm.
But being that he never got in the game, I'm guessing he's just spending time there trying to learn a little bit of English, just working on, you know, things like pitch recognition and stuff like that right now. But because of his upside, I can definitely see him putting him in the Gulf Coast League. I honestly think that's where we'll see him next year. That's what they did. That's what they do with that. Jose Vargas or something, or Fernandez. Jose Fernandez, he's a 17-year-old shortstop from the Dominican. That was in the Gulf Coast League this year, and he definitely has more tools than a guy like that.
Mm-hmm.
Right, and I think that's where we'll see him too. I think he'll be in the Gulf Coast League, and I think in terms of his progress, that he could even go higher than that. It just depends on what the coaching staff thinks when they watch him play. And if he's ready, we can see him in Greenville. We can even see him higher than that because we've seen that happen with some organizations and their really high signing bonus international free agents that they'll move him up, you know, even to single A ball sometimes in their first season in the States if they're really doing well.
It also depends on how he adjusts to American lifestyle. That's mm-hmm. That was one of the greatest things about the Gulf Coast League is it allows for all these Dominican and Venezuelan guys to come to the States in an environment that's not too far from what they're used to, because the majority of players down there are from Latin America, and so it's not too much of a change for him.
Yeah, and I'm not saying that he is going to advance past that point. You know, for all I know, probably the most likely thing is that he'll just be in Gold Coast League the entire short season. But I just think that he'll set his own pace in terms of both the skills and what you were talking about, how prepared he is to just go out and be in a regular minor league baseball.
Well, and the fact that we're even having this conversation shows that we do know that the Astros are aggressively moving guys through the system. And, you know, that hasn't been the case in the past. So that's really been encouraging for me to see just how aggressive the team can be with some of these guys that have a higher upside that need to be pushed a little bit. And that they're obviously taking it on a case-by-case basis with these guys and challenging them accordingly.
It provides motivation because the other players see that if they perform well, then they're going to move up. So if everybody just goes up a level every year, then there's not incentive.
But is that, you know, it's nice that they're saying that they're going to push guys through quicker. But my question is that just a front because there's no actual depth within the Astros minor league system, you know, that they can afford to move people quicker? Through the system quicker. Once they actually possibly get some depth, will that kind of slow down? You know, Obando being 17, he can come into that point where, you know, he's just starting to get blocked.
That's an interesting question. And to be honest, I have no idea what they're going to do. But a lot of our depth right now, probably will continue to be, is guys that are taking, you know, from rounds 10 through 20, guys like Daniel Adamson and stuff like that, that are in the lower minors and who are taken later, and they add to the depth. But, and so simply a guy like Obando is simply going to get the playing time over a guy like Daniel Adamson because he has the higher upside. And then once you have a lot more guys in the system, that's when I see Heck taking guys that have the higher upside who are the bigger signability risk. Because if we do fail to sign him, we still have the depth there. And so I think it's probably going to balance itself out with, you know, we won't be getting, instead of signing 19 or 18 of our top 20 picks, we'll be signing 15 or 16 instead. And it's not necessarily a bad thing if those 15 or 16 have a lot more upside.
Well, and I would argue too that the Astros have had a chance this year to push some guys that didn't deserve it maybe. And have shied away from that. Instead, they signed, you know, undrafted free agents. They signed street free agents like John Curtis and sent him into the minor leagues to fill some of those depth issues. So it's somewhat about depth. They have the luxury of aggressively promoting people because they don't have a lot of depth in the upper minor league system. But I also think that they're definitely evaluating whether a guy is ready to make the jump before they push them.
Yeah, that's probably a pretty good way to put it. I think there might be just a little bit of motivation because of things like you see Round Rock going over to the Rangers. They don't want that to happen with some of these other clubs, and fortunately we just renewed with Corpus Christi.
Mm-hmm.
So there is some motivation of getting some exciting prospects up there too, although I don't think it plays any like significant role. You know, it might be a little bit in their thought process, too.
All right, I'm going to take the conversation off topic here real quick. Is there any chance that Corpus Christi becomes a AAA affiliate? Because I know Round Rock at one point was a AA affiliate and became the AAA affiliate.
I personally don't think so. It's definitely an option, but I just don't see them pursuing that. Just because there's a lot of other factors that play into that, like getting admittance into the Pacific Coast League. You're taking a team away from the Texas League, which is already a small league to begin with, and Pacific Coast League is a pretty big league as it is. And so they're probably going to be a little bit more hesitant to take another AAA team. One of those teams would probably drop down, but I see them probably actively pursuing Oklahoma or Nashville, hopefully.
Well, and, you know, like you said, basically, to make Corpus Christi a AAA team, they have to buy a AAA team and move them there as an entrance into the Pacific Coast League or the International League. And minor league baseball is actually doing fairly well financially right now. So I don't know that there's the possibility that a team wants to be bought and moved to a different area. You know, most clubs have nice stadiums, they like the area, they're drawing pretty well, and, you know, you don't see the clubs folding as much in the minors as they used to.
It's kind of interesting to me, people who go out to these minor league games and go watch them a lot. I guess most of them are just rooting for them as a baseball team, but there's so much turnover, you know. And it illustrates to me that maybe there's not quite as much to the idea that you have to have stars who people know in order to draw crowds, considering that most of these guys that people only see for, you know, one season, maybe two at the most. I don't know, that's completely off topic, but just something I was thinking about.
So did that answer your question, Tim?
Yeah, that was just kind of something I've always thought about.
Yeah. Well, I think it would be neat to have the AAA affiliate there. But I also think there's something about, like, the capacity of the stadium. Like, it has to be to a certain point. And I don't know if Corpus meets that cutoff for the Pacific Coast League. And I'm sure that there's, like you were saying, Brooks, the Texas League can't really lose a team. So they would probably be financially incentivizing Corpus Christi to stay as a AA affiliate. Or that the Astros bring up a team from somewhere else.
Right. Well, I'm thinking, the three affiliates they talked about is OKC, Nashville, and Las Vegas.
Mm-hmm.
Those are a lot farther than Round Rock was as far as.
Las Vegas would be terrible, too.
Yeah, and, just getting guys to the major leagues, I think they've kind of, you know, it just seems like it'd be more convenient to have a AAA team in Texas, you know, Corpus Christi's, you know, what, a couple hours right. drive, you know, a few hours drive from Houston.
It really is. Like, that's definitely something that they're probably going to consider. But I know Farmers Row has posted a couple little stories about the traveling cost and how many one-way tickets there are from, like, Nashville to Houston on a daily basis. There's four. And then the prices of a ticket, which, I mean, yeah, it'd be a little bit more expensive than a drive from Round Rock to Houston, but it wouldn't be that much more expensive.
Right, and the AAA team before Round Rock was New Orleans, so, you know, I could see them going to Nashville easy. And these, I mean, they don't seem like, you know, out in the Northeast or Northwest or anything. But,
right.
Just something I had kind of a question about it, since they've done that before with Round Rock, being a double-A team before.
As long as we're on this topic, though, in terms of I just looked up the minor league park factors for their run environments, in case anyone was interested, Oklahoma and Nashville are both actually slightly pitcher-friendly. You know, they're pretty neutral. Nashville a little bit more so. Las Vegas would... Why I said it would be horrible is because it's basically another Lancaster. It's one of the most hitter-friendly ballparks in baseball.
Yeah, and so. We definitely don't need another Lancaster. Another factor to consider with Nashville, though, is although the current financial situation for the city of Nashville isn't the greatest because of the floods and stuff like that, but one of the reasons why Nashville is an option it's because Milwaukee is considering pulling out because the talks about making a new stadium have been put on hold because of financial situations. And so because of these player contracts are 2 or 4 years, whichever, if Houston does decide to go with Nashville within the next, before the end of the player development contract is up, it's a pretty good possibility that there would be a whole new stadium that would be state of the art.
No, another thing, I know Brooks, I know you live near Nashville, or don't you live in Nashville?
Yeah, I actually live like 15 minutes at most from the stadium.
Well, just today, my wife said, we need to go visit Nashville. I've never been there before. I was like, okay. Just gotta make sure it's during next season.
Yeah, well, we could definitely meet up for a game. That would be great. I know I'm planning, if they move to if they move their AAA affiliate to Nashville, I'm probably going to be there pretty often.
Okay, so why don't we get back? We've got a couple more prospects to talk about before we touch on the 2010 draft, which has a number of players in the top 20. Tim, why don't you talk about JD Martinez and why you felt he was a top 25 player in the country?
Because he can rake. That's my only reason. I mean, the guy has above 900 OPS. I know he's probably not the John Singleton or anything who has a ridiculous OPS, well over 1.2 something. But that's all lower A. But he just seems to continue at each level, just continues to rake. And everything I've read about him, I've liked what I've seen. And to have a high, and I may have ranked him higher because we haven't had a big hitting prospect mm-hmm. come through the system since Hunter Pence. Mm-hmm. So to kind of see that, you know, you kind of get a little excited about that. And the fact that he can, you know, he's probably going to play the outfield. And I guess I see him possibly taking over for Carlos Lee since his contract ends in 2012. Hopefully, maybe this offseason he gets traded. But to see him come through the system, especially as a 20th round pick, is kind of nice. And I just every single stat I looked at for him, I just really liked about him. Like I said, the OPS is over 900 and it looks to continue to be over 900.
Well, and also the great thing about Martinez is, you know, he's talked about in interviews the experience playing at a Division II school. He had to see a lot more breaking stuff than most guys do in Division I because the guys in Division II don't have great fastballs. So if they want to get people out, they got to do a heavy diet of breaking balls, change-ups, things like that. And I think that's helped him transition up the system because he doesn't have to make the adjustments that a guy like Jordan Lyles may have to do, who's, you know, basically brand new to that level of competition, you know, seeing pitches that, you know, like the Sam Bull Durham, the ungodly breaking stuff. Martinez has that experience, and I think that'll ultimately help him transition to AAA and then the major leagues.
I actually went to a Division II school, so I got to watch a lot of pitchers, and I mean, even frontline starters at Division II are throwing, you know, their fastballs for a right-hander is 85. That's some of the top stuff you get to see, and so. And they really do. They throw a whole lot more curveballs and a whole lot more changeups. And that pitch recognition is what has really allowed him to really succeed because he is able to wait on his pitch a whole lot better. You can see with his walk rate, you know, at 8.5 when he was in Lexington, dropped down a little bit to 7 when he was in Corpus, which, I mean, it's a pretty solid. I mean, he's able to. He really knows how to hit, and it's because he's able to recognize those pitches.
That's one of those things that's so hard to measure in scouting, and that's why sometimes we'll see guys like JD Martinez, and I'm not saying that he's going to be like this, but Albert Pujols was one of those guys. One of the main reasons why he's so incredible and lasted so long is because he has incredible pitch recognition, and obviously JD Martinez is not that level of a talent, but that's what makes him a really good prospect, despite the fact that he was a Division II 20th round, completely, you know, almost completely off the radar kind of prospect. And that's something that scouts need to work on perhaps a little more, is identifying guys with great pitch recognition.
Well, and I think it's also something saying when the organization says, oh, you don't even know, you don't need to go to Lancaster. We're just going to send you to Corpus Christi. He went from Lexington to Corpus Christi. In Lexington, he put up the ridiculous numbers. Now, he struggled a little bit in Corpus Christi. But as Dave mentioned earlier, there's a different competition level there. And you're really starting to get into the, you know, kind of the meat of the minor league systems and better competition. So. And even with his lowered OPS, he was still batting 302 with a 357 on base percentage in Corpus Christi, which, you know, I don't think a whole lot of prospects are doing it in the minor league system at this point. So yeah, I just love the guy.
Well, and they recently named him MVP of the Sally League, and he hasn't even played there in like a month and a half. Which just shows you, and I think those awards are based on like managers and sometimes players voting. So that shows you the kind of respect they had for his talent level when he was in that league.
Yeah, and I mean, I know you can find there's a video on on YouTube that interviews him after he had a game-winning hit. And, you know, he's a charismatic guy. You know, he's a guy that is real under control. He definitely plays a part of a team leader, and so which only helps him as far as, you know, a clubhouse figure and everything like that, which helps. And still, I mean, even in his Corpus Christi numbers, his ISO has really gone down, but he's still hitting.
Well, and I think that's the biggest question mark with him is his power. You know, I don't think he's got that elite level power, and I don't think he's really got enough time to develop it. So if he's a 20 home run guy who can hit 300 in the majors, that's useful. That's a useful starter, but I don't know that he's a star necessarily.
Yeah, and I think we still have questions about if he's even, I hate to say it, but I do think we have questions about if he's even a 20 home run guy. Because mm-hmm. his ISO really did drop a lot in Corpus Christi, and I have seen some people who've seen him play who said that they don't know whether he was just hitting mistakes in single A ball or whether he's actually does have that legitimate power. So, you know, he could even be a 15 homer guy who sprays a lot of doubles around the field. But, you know, even then he could still be an above average starter in left field. But we still have some questions about how he's going to translate to the upper minors. And to be fair, while his performance has been solid at Corpus Christi, it hasn't been enough that you feel like he's an incredible prospect.
Well, I think the organization's new philosophy of challenging some of these young players is playing into that. You know, he could stay at Lexington this entire year, he would put up ridiculous numbers. And then next year go to Double A, he may have put up another, you know, obviously we can't tell that, but he may have put up some more ridiculous numbers. So I think maybe the organization pushing him might, you know, contribute to him, you know, post at 763 OPS at AA. You know, it's definitely going to be interesting
right.
next year to see how well he does and if he can bounce back from this poor start. And even if you consider what he's posted so far, poor start, I mean, that's still pretty good.
Yeah, it's solid. I don't want to say he's done poor, you know, I don't want to really even say he's done poorly just by his standards, which were incredible up to this point, and we had kind of hoped that he would maintain those standards. But like you said, I think next year is going to be really important, and that's kind of why I put him at more the grade that I put him at, which was a solid B-, kind of leaning more closer to B, but not quite in that top 100 range yet, because I want to see what he does next year, and I want to see what his power is and what kind of adjustments he makes against advanced pitching at AA and AAA.
Well, we also have to, you know, be mindful of the fact that he made a really, really big jump. There's a big difference in the quality of pitching and the amount of movement between low A and double. And so that's why I kind of attribute his decline in power pretty much to him not getting as solid of contact, because the movement on those pitches is so much more. But I'm confident because of his ability to adjust as much as he has to continue to put up, you know, I'm not going to say he's going to be a 25 home run guy at all, but I think closer to 20, you know, maybe 18 to 20 is a pretty good estimate once he adjusts to the amount of movement that he's seeing.
But the last guy in the top 10 that's not from the 2010 draft is Jay Austin. I had him a little higher than some of you guys. I had him as a solid B prospect, because I think he's shown quite a bit this year and shown the potential for some power if the Astros let him hit for power. There's been some question on whether they're trying to tailor his swing to be more like Michael Bourne. And I also think there's some questions about him, his base-stealing instincts. I think he gets caught a little too much for how much he runs. But I've been really impressed with Jay Austin this year.
I have too, and until the day, in fact, I had him ranked a little bit higher, but I kind of went down and I tried to be a little, you know, subdue my Astros homerism a little bit more today and lowered all my grades by just a little bit. But I'm really high on Jay Austin, and I think he has an argument for being our second best prospect. And I'm not worried about his caught stealing numbers because they're trying to push their boundaries. They're told to, and that's what they're attempting to do is to learn when they're going to get caught and when they're not. So they have to mess up, especially for a speedster like Jay Austin, where base stealing is a huge part of his game. And I think he'll just get better and better at that as he advances up the minors. And the reason why he's such a good prospect is, one, he has incredible tools. And two, he's 19 years old, and he's performing right around league average against pitchers who are like 3 years older than he is. So when you adjust for his age and how raw he is, and then you factor in his tools, I think that makes him a really good prospect. And he could develop into one of the best center field prospects in the minors, depending on how he fares against double-A pitching.
Yeah, next year's really going to tell a lot about Jay Austin. It's really going to let us know whether or not he's a stud prospect or if he's nothing more than organizational, you know, depth. But I'm with you. He has great tools. He definitely has the tools to be, you know, put up much more home run power than anybody else that's going to be a center fielder. But, you know, that is definitely a question mark. Like what David was saying is whether or not the Astros are tinkering with his swing to be more of a ground ball hitter and beating out infield hits and stuff like that. Personally, I think it's a bad thing. You know, you're limiting what he can do because you're limiting that power potential that he definitely has. But at the same time, though, he hasn't been necessarily hitting to the point where, you know, he's a 300 hitter or something like that. So that just may be something that the Astros are being able to see because they're actually being able to watch him. They just might be able to be seeing something that they think in his swing will not translate to being able to hit successfully at a major league level. So it may be something they're just seeing and they're wanting to change it because they don't think it will translate.
Well, and I think that it may be the kind of thing where they want to get him to the point where he can make contact when he wants to. And they want him to just hit for power when he finds a mistake pitch that he can really drive. And that might be a good thing, because if he can take that kind of two-strike approach and put the ball on the ground and he gets into a pitcher's count, that'll help him hit for average and post better strikeout rates as he moves up the levels and faces better pitching. And then he still does have the ability to let it loose and take a big rip when he gets in a hitter's count and he gets something he can drive.
Yeah.
Well, and
go ahead.
Well, and if Omar Epps taught us nothing in Major League 2, it's that speedy center fielders should not fall in love with the long ball. So there is that.
I think he's a devil. He's got if you looked at his minor league career OPS, it's 666. How is
that not a devil? I did not realize the devil had a Twitter feed. So that's kind of scary.
Well, you don't even follow him, do you?
Oh, I do. I do.
I thought you couldn't follow him because of your family and friends.
No.
You decided to take the plunge?
Yeah. So, yeah, and, you know, I think, like we've talked about with his stealing numbers, I think if the Astros are working on his bunting and contact skills right now, it may be because he needs to improve those at this level of the minors. And then as he moves up higher, they may try to put everything together. So it's not something I'm completely concerned about, and I do like that he has shown good power this year, which is, I think, why I was a little bit higher than some of you guys on him, because I think the tools are there, and he is performing at a good level in a league that's advanced for his age.
This ends part one of what could turn into about four different parts of the podcast. We will resume talking about the 2010 draft and some of the prospects to come in the system, and that should post Wednesday morning. So thanks for listening, and we'll talk to you later, TCB.